Okay, famine. On from one jolly subject to another. Am I depressing you too much? No? Yeah, well, it'll be spring soon. Famine. Famine is, the first point about famine is that it's different from hunger and malnutrition. Definition is famine is a state of extreme hunger suffered by the population of a region as a result of the failure of the accustomed food supply. It is to be distinguished from the more or less constant undernourishment of chronically poverty-stricken districts. Say 2 billion people on this planet, a third, still are hungry, malnourished, etc., maybe more. But those people aren't living in famine. They just don't know when their next meal is coming. Their children's stomachs are distended and all that sort of thing. But this isn't famine. I think a very nice, it's a horrible short definition of it, is that famine is a condition in which you are dying by inches. Dying by inches means that your body, because it's so depleted, eats up your reserves of the body, your body fat. And so you die, as it were, withdrawing all your parts of your body, and hence it can be extremely painful. You usually don't actually die in the end from famine itself. You usually die from a disease which takes you away because you're so weak. The great famines in India in the early part of the 20th century, for example, it was malaria and cholera and other diseases. So famine is something that, the metaphor that's often used is stalking. It stalked the world. Famine stalked the world until very recently, and you'll be surprised how recently. It still does, of course, but big, large-scale famines, I hadn't really realized. All this stuff, if you want the details, is on my website under The Savage Wars of Peace, that book and other subjects. But basically, most peasant civilizations suffered from periodic famine all the time until the last 100 years or so. That's to say, China, a great study of Chinese famine, found that between 108 BC and 1911 there was drought or famine in some Chinese province every year in that period, not the whole of China. And they're big famines. For example, in the famine related to the war, the Taiping I mentioned, 1876 to 1879, 9 million people died. I'm sure you know when the greatest Chinese famine of the last 500 years was. Do people know? Sorry? Yeah. Chairman Mao, in one of his misguided policies, the Great Leap Forward, when he got the farmers to stop farming and chasing sparrows instead and building little kilns in their backyards and so on. 1959-62, something between 20 and 30 million people died in China. The greatest slaughter, apart from Comrade Stalin, who I'll come to in a minute. If any of you have any predispositions, as I did as an undergraduate, towards communism, do take into account the effects it's had through its misguided idealism. India, a place which when I was your age was synonymous with famine. There were famines happening when I was an undergraduate. For example, the Bangladesh, Bengal, Assam famine were in 1974-5, so that's only 30 years ago, 1.8 million people died in that famine. The Beatles did a famous record to try and get famine aid. The very famous Bengal famine during the Second World War, 1943-4, between 1.5 and 3 million people died. And I'll come back to that. But in the 19th century, there were huge famines. Between 1860 and 1900, some 19 million people are thought to have died. And it goes back to the time, the middle of the 17th century, when the British arrived. But as I say, most people died in the end of disease rather than hunger. Russia was famine prone. There were 11 major famines in the 19th century. 1921, 2-3 million people died, and 1932, Stalin tried the same thing as Chairman Mao, collectivizing the farms and so on, and caused a terrible famine in those years with some millions of people dying. Scandinavia had serious famines until the end of the 18th century, until 1800. My native Scotland, there were still serious famines until the end of the 18th century, and in France and in Italy. The last big famine locally was the 1845-6 Irish potato famine, in which more than 1 million people died. So most countries have not escaped from famine until quite recently, and some still have famines, and they're predicted to be more in the future. But I wanted, before I give you two further examples, I want to give you some theories about the causes and preventions of famine. So what causes famine? I mean, you may think, if someone asked you in your college bar what causes famine, you'd say, well, a shortage of food, obviously. And then if they said, well, why is food short? You would probably say, well, something's happened to the agricultural system, like there's too much water, or there's too little water, or there are locusts or crop failures of some kind or other. That was the widespread view of what caused famine when I was your age. But there are two other interesting theories which I'll bring to your attention and then look at one or two examples. One theory is the theory put forward by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations. He argued that the cause of famine is not economic, is not agricultural, but is political, namely government interference in the working of the market. Scarcities, which is different from famine, are caused by war and the weather, but a famine has never arisen, he said, from any other cause but the violence of government attempting by improper means to remedy the inconveniences of a dearth. In other words, the government steps in, starts buying up grain, hoarding it, or forcing the producers of grain to sell it cheap. And the whole market, the invisible hand of the market, is dislocated, and there's a panic, and there's a famine. He stated that in an extensive corn country, between all the different parts of which there is free commerce and communication, the scarcity occasioned by the most unfavorable seasons can never be so great as to produce a famine. So as long as the market, and this is me, as long as the market is allowed to operate freely, the laws of supply and demand will prevent a famine. They'll balance out. In other words, if there's a shortage, then the price will go up and the grains will be pulled in from where they're more available. But, he says, when the government, in order to remedy the inconveniences of a dearth, orders all the dealers to sell their corn at what is supposed a reasonable price, it either hinders them from bringing it to market, in other words, they hoard it to get even a better price, which may sometimes produce a famine, even in the beginning of the season, or if they bring it thither, it enables the people and thereby encourages them to consume it so fast as must necessarily produce a famine before the end of the season. So that suddenly the market is glutted because the government said, put all your grains on the market, and people think everything's fine. They eat it all up, and at the end of the season, there's a famine. Now, the important thing about this idea, which you'll find in The Wealth of Nations, is that Smith was the most influential of any economist who has ever lived. And his Wealth of Nations became the Bible for politicians. They read The Wealth of Nations, they went to Oxford and Cambridge, and they read The Wealth of Nations, and this was the truth. And it was taken up and repeated by Malthus, one of the reasons why some people hate him. And Malthus taught many of those who ruled the empire. He was the economics master at Haileybury and Imperial Services College for a number of years. So he not only set the doctrine, but taught the people who went out to India and elsewhere. And they went with this idea that you leave it to market forces. Now, this again, as I mentioned, communism has led to many tragic deaths through idealism and well-meaning attempts to try and galvanize the economy by Mao and Stalin. The same is true of capitalism of this kind, because though Adam Smith was a delightful, gentle man, and Malthus was quite a nice man too, they unwittingly led to the deaths of millions of people. Because this idea that you don't interfere, the government doesn't interfere, is what was applied with the Irish potato famine. So 1 or 2 million people died in Ireland because the government said, well, leave it to the market, don't interfere, read your Smith and Malthus. And the same thing in India. What it's based on is Adam Smith's experience of England, above all, and to a certain extent France and other places he'd been to, which was a very opulent, rich, well-organized, highly monetized post-peasant. It had never been peasant in my view, but anyway, some people think it had emerged from peasantry. So it was a proper working, functioning market economy. So for instance, when there were food shortages in London, as there were from time to time in the 17th century, they brought grain in from the West Country or from Holland or from somewhere else by boat because the price had gone up. And it was regulated. So it worked. There hadn't been famines in England, as I mentioned, or as I will tell you about in a minute. So basically it works here, but the criticism of Malthus and Smith, above all by Amartya Sen, the late master of Trinity, who got a Nobel Prize for his book on called Famine on this particular subject. His criticism was that, although he doesn't quite say it like this, I think it's now clearer in hindsight, is that Smith and Malthus apply to capitalist market societies. He doesn't say it, as I say, in this way. What he does say is that having examined various famines in the Third World, he particularly looked at the Ethiopian and the Bengal famines. He was born in Bengal, he's Indian. He was brought up in the Bengal famine, and therefore he knew it. He was very young, but he knew it personally. And when he looked at it, and if any of you read about it, and in his book or elsewhere, he finds that in this case, the British taking the view that you shouldn't use the railways to bring in food and so on, led to an artificial famine. There was no absolute shortage of food. There was food elsewhere in India, and it could have been brought in and used, but it wasn't, because it would be interfering with the market. Basically, although it's not quite how Sen puts it, we're dealing with pre-market economies here. In other words, the laws of supply and demand don't work in the capitalist way. The reasons for this, as Sen shows, is that where there is demand in one sense, in other words, people are starving to death, there isn't demand in the economic sense because they don't have any wealth. They don't have, in his famous word, entitlements. They have no entitlement. They can starve. They have nothing to draw the food to them. They've sold off their last animals and their last bits of furniture and sticks and so on. They have nothing. And so they have no entitlements, and they can create no economic demand for food, no purchasing power. He argues, that is Sen, that a food-centered view tells us rather little about starvation. We need to look at the food going to particular groups, as he puts it. He agrees with the idea that starvation may be caused not by food shortage, but by the shortage of income and purchasing power. And he begins to unravel the difficulty, but points out that income and purchasing power assumes a monetized market economy. So entitlement is much wider. You have entitlement if you have some economic weight, but if you're in many societies, you have hardly any of that. And peasantries, by definition, which are embedded societies, societies where only a small part of your life is paid for by cash, most of it is self-subsistence economy. Produce 90% of your food and so on and so on. In that situation, if that your internal self-subsistence is undermined, you don't have anything to bring in food from elsewhere. Most peasants don't have income in the normal sense, which can be quantified in monetary terms. Thus their entitlement is always weak. But in a period of food shortage it fades away entirely, as we see in the distressing pictures of nomadic pastoralists, for example, in Africa selling off their last animals to try and just get a little bit of food. This is nothing to do with government price fixing. It's all to do, this is my interpretation, with the development over time of large masses of the population who are politically and socially weak and live on the edge of starvation. So Sen's famous criticism, which as I mentioned gained him a lot of international prestige, is a good counterweight or argument to Smith and Malthus. But it's also, I think, it isn't explicit enough about where the Sen argument would work. It works in peasant societies, whereas Smith works in capitalist societies. But there's a further criticism, which is that we're dealing, in fact, with two possible cases. One is where there's a capitalism, one where there's peasantry. There's a third case, which is where there is an absolute shortage. It's not a matter of the market forces not being strong enough. It's not a matter of no entitlements. It's just that there is no food over very large areas. That's the case in a way with the famine I mentioned of Chairman Mao's. I mean, it was huge areas, the size of, say, France or Spain, i.e. a Chinese province, were without food. And the cost of sending food, of course, unless you've got water communications, and much of China, some parts of China had it, but other parts didn't. Cost of sending food is hopeless unless you've got railways or water, because you consume all the food. You just have to send an animal for a week or two and then it'll have had to have eaten all the food it's carrying. So you couldn't send any food from a distant part of China. And so huge areas of China just had absolutely no food. And this is the same to a certain extent in some of the Russian famines in parts of Africa now and so on. In other words, there are situations which are so dire that another case in point might be North Korea, as you probably know, perhaps one of the worst famines in the first part of the 21st century was in North Korea, or at the end of the last century, with perhaps 1 or 2 million people dying of starvation. Absolutely no food. I mean, it's political in the sense that there was food in China and Japan and elsewhere, and it could have come in, but to a large extent people just starved because for large areas there was no food. So in this situation the mind moves to what could possibly prevent such kinds of famines, and here it's a matter of building up an infrastructure over a long period. Most of these areas which had these huge famines about which you could do very little were monocultural. They were growing rice or a certain kind of grain over hundreds, thousands of miles. And the famines are caused when suddenly there's too much rain or too much heat, not enough rain. And there's just nothing, no food available. So you need much longer term planning. That's why if the world was really keen and the leaders of our world were keen on trying to deal with this problem, they've got to think in a very, very large global way to eliminate famine. I mean, there is the last sort of cheerful point about this, perhaps, on the general arguments, is that something strange happened in relation to famine. When I was at your age and at university, as I mentioned, there were famines occurring in India. There had been quite a recent famine in China and so on, which we didn't know about, of course, but Africa had famines. Now India, which is one of the extraordinary miracles, I mean, it has huge droughts, rapidly growing population, and yet we don't hear much about famine in India. And so that's been a success. China's been a huge success. Those two alone account for nearly half the world's population. So there has been tremendous success, but of course sub-Saharan Africa and North Korea and a few other cases still exist and should be ameliorated as soon as possible. Turning to the question of when famine first declined, I'd like to just end by giving you two examples which are similar to the ones that I mentioned with war. The first country that, to my knowledge, that really escaped from famine was England. I mean, Holland, of course, but Holland was later. The last famine in England, I don't know when you know this, but the last famine in England, that's a serious death rate, was in between 1315 and 1319. There was huge rainfall and bad climate and animal disease and all sorts of things, and perhaps 10% of the English population died, maybe 500,000 people. The only other famine after that was small localized famines in northwest England, what is now the Lake District area, Cumbria, in 1587 and 1597. Perhaps 10% of the population in that area also died through food shortages. And here you're talking of 10 to 20,000 people, much smaller, and some of them coming down starving from Scotland. So by the middle of the 17th century, as the writers of the main book on famine in England, Walter and Schofield, put it, by the mid-17th century, therefore, England had slipped the shadow of famine, in sharp contrast to the continuing vulnerability of most of the West European countries. It's again a question of why that happened. It's partly the water communications that I mentioned to you. It's partly to do with the variability of English agriculture. It's partly to do with the fact that it's always been a very rich country. It has animal husbandry, it has different grains, and for most of its history it's lived well above subsistence with a big, efficient market economy. So its economy was well beyond famine, really, after about the 14th century, and there haven't been any famine since. People have died of starvation in the streets of London, of course, probably still do, but certainly in the 18th century they did, but not famine. The other place which early escaped from famine was Japan, once again, an island with water communications and variable agriculture and ecological zones very close together. It had fairly serious famines a bit later than England. For instance, in the 18th century, there's a famine, the Kyoho famine in Kyushu, which is the southern island. Kyoho is K-Y-O-H-O. In 1732, where there was heavy rain and insect infestation, and something like 20% of the population in some of the domains died. But that's about 15,000 people altogether, of a population of about 20 million. The Temmai famine, T-E-M-M-E-I famine of 1782-5, because of volcanic ash and floods and so on. Some tens of thousands of people died in central Japan, and in the last great famine, the Tempo famine, T-E-M-P-O, of 1830s, again tens of thousands died out of about 30 million population. But on the whole, though you'll see in some of the Kurosawa films and elsewhere, you'll see bodies floating down Japanese rivers, and people lived in great poverty in parts of Japan. On the whole, Japan was early to escape from the serious kinds of famine you find in many landlocked countries. So just to conclude, it's difficult to know what to talk about with strategies of survival. One could talk about individual strategies of people in poorer countries who are trying to survive against disease, famine, and so on, or one could do it at a very general level, as I've tried to do here. But I would like to end on the more individual. I thought of showing you some films about the work I do in the Himalayas, but I put them on YouTube. If you go on to YouTube and have a look under Virtual Village, I think it's called, you'll see three or four films, one of which I particularly made for you because it shows members of my family in this Himalayan village struggling against living on an incredibly difficult terrain. A steep mountain where there's no wheel, and everything has to be carried on the shoulder, all the grinding. The whole thing is done by human labor, more or less. And the terrible toll of heavy labor in third world countries, which would have been another topic for these lectures, is another part of the strategies of survival. And of course, the strategy of survival that these people have taken which is one of the great strategies of survival now for most people in poor countries, is to leave, is to go away, is to flee this terrible poverty and humiliating and endless drudgery of that kind of work. And many of my family now are in London and Hong Kong and elsewhere. And so I would like to end by paying a tribute to my sister, Dil Maya, who died of heavy overwork, probably with a heart attack at the age of 1940, at the age of 42, 1995, and to whom one of my books is, The Savage Wars of Peace, is dedicated. And thank you very much for coming to my lectures. Thank you.